the biggest misconception is probably they think that these kids are blowing their money, that they're spending it on frivolous things. And yeah, sometimes they might buy or lease a car or something. But a lot of our kids and other programs I've spoken to is a lot of these kids are giving their money to people back home, looking after their family. There are some really cool stories about what they're doing there selflessly. And I think, you know, there's all this rage like, oh, these kids shouldn't be paid that much. They're going to waste it and they don't appreciate the value of money. But what I found is that for the most part, they really do. And it's a lot about giving back. And I think if we could get some of those stories out there, that'll probably bring the temperature down of the criticism of players getting NIL.
Welcome to Self-Equity, the podcast that dives into the inspiring journeys of founders, entrepreneurs, athletes, and entertainers. I'm your host, Jolene Tepedino, authorized officer and team business manager for the Zellniger, Dorfman, Carr, and Heritage Group at UBS. Today on episode 27 of the Self-Equity podcast, we're joined by Banuk Dithawaku, Chief Football Strategy Officer at Duke University. He leads the program's approach to name, image, and likeness, roster strategy, and analytics. We'll explore how Duke is innovating in NIL and preparing athletes for long-term success on and off the field. Co-hosting with me today is Ryan Lynch, Financial Advisor with the Zellniger, Dorfman, Carr, and Heritage Group. Hi, Banuk. Thanks for joining us today on our Self-Equity podcast.
Hey, Jolene. Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me. Excited to do this with you guys.
So, Banuk, you started your career in Australia and then transitioned into the U.S., college athletics. You're currently the Chief Football Strategy Officer at Duke. Can you share with us your path here and tell us a little bit more about your role?
I did start in Australia, but technically I did have a stint in the U.S. before I went back to Australia as well. So, traversed both continents. So how I started. So in Australia, law school is something that you do as an undergrad. So I went to law school straight out of high school and then realized pretty early into the law school career that I wasn't going to be a good lawyer. And there were just so many people that loved the law that I just didn't love the law. I didn't love reading all the cases, but I understood there were some important skills to be taken from that degree. So I stayed with that degree and was trying to find something I'm really passionate about. And sports was something that I'd played a lot growing up and something that, you know, was a big part of my life. So wanted to go down the path of being a sports agent. So during university, kind of set up a sports agency with a couple of more seasoned professionals, an athlete, a real estate agent, and a lawyer. That's probably the start of a funny joke. And then, yeah, we represented Australian football players and some Olympians. That went really well. And then when I finished my degree, moved to the US, where I actually interned with an NFL agent and then worked on the commercial side at the Washington Wizards. So from there, realized I really liked the front office space and wanted to get more into that side of things. So moved back to Australia, worked in sports betting, which was legal in Australia for decades. I know it's just recently become legal in the US. And then from that, was able to develop an analytical skill set that was viewed favorably by some front offices in Australian sports. So I was in charge of analytics and salary cap management for an Australian football team, the Adelaide Crows. And then from there, 2020, COVID kind of hit. My then fiance, now wife, is an American. So it was very hard for her to travel back to see family. So she proposed the idea of moving to the US for a little bit. I was just going to work for a professional sports team in the US, but then she put the idea in my head of doing an MBA. We had a discussion. I said, look, if I get into Duke, I'll do it because I could work with the sports teams. If not, I'll just go work. So fortunate to get into the Duke MBA program. And then through that, worked with the basketball team and then helped set up our NIL collective. And that's where the old football coach, Mike Elko, had heard about my experience. And he asked me to work in-house with him. And then when he left for Texas A&M, I still had 6 months of my degree to go. So I wasn't in a position to move to College Station. And then Coach Diaz came in. I kind of told him, look, this is our NIL landscape. This is how it all looks. Use me as much as you want or as little as you want. I finished up here in 6 months and then I'm probably out of here. We then built like a really strong relationship and I'm still here 2 years later. So, or a year and a half later.
So your background blends law, commerce, and analytics. How do you bring those different perspectives into the strategy of a football program?
It's a good question. I think it all really helps with probably the first part is like process thinking. That's the key. So both those backgrounds really help with just understanding like the order of operations of certain things, like how do we build a team? What are the key components of building a team? And really thinking through some of the opportunity costs as well of making certain decisions. So I think having that lens more from the economics and law side really helps. The other thing with the law side is the negotiation of contracts and then also understanding the contracts that are put in front of our athletes, both from ourselves now with RevShare, but also third parties. So a lot of the athletes, I know some have agents, but come into my office and say, look, I've got this deal. What do you think? And I can help them work through some of that. So that's where that helps. And the analytics, obviously, that helps with identifying talent. Really don't profess to be able to code at the level of some of these students at Duke or, you know, some of these younger students, but I can understand the coding and I can then help translate some of our data models to the coaches who might not be as technically proficient as I am. So that really helps as well, acting as a conduit between the really smart data scientists and then our non-technical stakeholders.
So Binuk, if you could, analytics is a big buzzword. I think it's in sports. It started in baseball. And, you know, with the playoffs going on right now, you see different statistics being emphasized than, you know, you would have even 10 years ago, let alone 20, 30 years ago. So for the folks listening to you, what are analytics? How are they different than traditional stats, if they are at all? And how do you use those to not only compile a roster, but try to create competitive advantages?
Yeah, so I think the first part of that question, like, what are analytics? I think they're just another tool in our decision-making toolkit to help us make smarter decisions. I don't think they are the be-all and end-all, but they're also important. They're not. It's not a negligible level of importance. So I think being able to understand that analytics is just one part of the toolkit, the coach's subjective opinion, our scout's subjective opinion, that's another part. And we have to work out how to blend that together. I think where teams globally have got in trouble is when they either ignore the analytics too much or they go too far down of just listening to the analytics. So it's a fine balance that, you know, you have to carve out. And then the really important analytics, and we have a great partner, they're called Big League Advantage, that do a lot of our analytical modeling for us. Like, the big part of the statistics that are really important are the percentages over expected. So whether that's a catch percentage, a completion percentage, ability to stay in the pocket over expected, those are the real key metrics that help us make decisions on players. Like, okay, where are you relative to the average player at your position for these key metrics for your position? So that's how we utilize them. I don't know if that's right or wrong, but I think we have been relatively successful, especially with our transfer portal additions that, you know, were heavily driven by the analytics.
Getting back to NIL and RevShare. First, if you can kind of walk through, because RevShare is a relatively new concept, especially for collegiate football, what that is for folks. And then also at a school like Duke, where football is a major component in the athletic department, ACC football is big time. You also have a major basketball program. Are there, you know, levers that pull each way? Like, do you feel constricted at times because of how big the basketball program is? How is it different at other academic institutions? Just kind of walk us through that.
Yeah. So RevShare, what that is prior to July 1 this year, schools, the way that players received NIL were from third parties, but then there was a court case that was settled. And then the outcome of that was that schools can directly pay up to $20.5 million across their athletic department. The schools get to decide how they divide that up by which sport. And then also there's another component for additional scholarships and Alston money, which also comes within that $20.5 million umbrella. Director and her team decide how to allocate within those different buckets. We obviously put our case forward for what we think is necessary for football. Men's basketball and women's basketball put their case forward, and any other sport. So without kind of sharing the exact percentages that we've decided to divide up, like, we are comfortable with the number that we've gotten, and we have to really work with men's basketball as well and understand, like, okay, what do you guys need? What do we need? How do we work together to maximize both teams? And then a benefit of the men's basketball program, obviously, is, you know, they get a lot of high-level recruits that probably can get those third-party NIL deals a lot easier than football players can, and they understand that. So we all kind of work together to figure out, you know, our piece of the pie.
And you had mentioned the transfer portal. How do you use analytics in your role to build a roster, trying to figure out at a collegiate level, players who already have college tape, what their level of performances versus high school recruits when you're trying to build out and allocate spots to those folks?
The way we are at Duke is like we see ourselves as a developmental program. So the majority of our players are going to be players that we've developed internally, but we will supplement our roster with selective transfer portal additions. And we never want to get into that position where we're, you know, bringing in guys that are making so much more money than our existing starters. And that's something that, you know, I tell agents and players and families when I negotiate is that, like, we want to respect the guys that have been here, that have been through the program, that have earned their starting spot. Now, where there's an instance where, you know, like a guy might no longer be on the team, or, you know, we have to get significantly better and that person isn't a starter, then we will bring players in on the portal. But yeah, one thing that we've been pretty steadfast on is that, like, we want to reward the guys that have been through the program and have done all the hard yards, because we've got a pretty relentless strength coach who's we think one of the best in the country, if not the best, and he puts our guys through grueling off-season workouts, so we want to make sure that they're rewarded for going through that.
Binuck, from a financial education standpoint, financial literacy, how do you help student athletes think long-term about their money instead of just, you know, short-term endorsement deals or big-ticket items? What is that process like?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there's obviously somewhat of a conflict of interest where, like, you know, we're not going to put seven financial advisors in front of them and say, okay, you got to pick one. So what we do is we do a lot of education pieces. We have, fortunately, being at Duke, like, you have a lot of successful alumni that are willing to share their time and work through, you know, how they made financial decisions that we'll put them in front of our players. And then we'll kind of tell them there are resources where, you know, we can get them connected to financial advisors and things like that if that's what they need. But yeah, we really leverage a lot of our alumni to tell the story of how they mistakes they made when they were kind of just thinking short term to their successes long term. And I think that resonates the most with the players is actually seeing people that have, you know, walked in their shoes, not in the same extent that they didn't have NIL then, but have gone on to really successful careers in finance, maybe some at UBS, that, you know, have been able to manage their money and really tell these guys where they should be putting their money. That's rather than kind of getting, you know, us just shoving people down their throat, oh, you've got to work with X, Y, and Z.
Give them the foundation, teach them the basics, talk to them about taxes, you know, things of that nature. If you're making X, you're not taking home X. What do you think are some of the biggest misconceptions that fans or players or, you know, anyone really have about the NIL?
The biggest misconception probably, they think that these kids are blowing their money, that they're spending it on frivolous things. And yeah, you know, sometimes they might buy or lease a car or something. But a lot of our kids and other programs I've spoken to is a lot of these kids are giving their money to people back home, looking after their family. There are some really cool stories about what they're doing there selflessly. And I think, you know, there's all this rage like, oh, these kids shouldn't be paid that much. They're going to waste it and they don't appreciate the value of money. But what I've found is that for the most part, they really do. And it's a lot about giving back. And our cornerback, Chandler Rivers, who's been a really good player for us, one thing he does every summer is organizes a football camp for kids in his hometown. So like things like that, where they're putting their money back into their communities, that's not reported as much. So I think if we could get some of those stories out there, that'll probably bring the temperature down of the criticism of players getting NIL.
That's great. It should be highlighted more. I was just at Villanova doing an NIL event with UBS on campus for the men's and women's basketball program. One of the biggest concerns that the players had mentioned at that, and that the coaches are actively involved in trying to help with, is dealing with family members back home. All of a sudden, you have these student athletes making money that they hadn't had before, oftentimes coming from families that need help. And establishing boundaries and really trying to make the families understand that, like, yes, they're making money, but also they have to get established first before they can help, because this money may not last. Not everyone goes to the NFL or the NBA. How do you guys as a program work with these kids to make sure that that pressure of feeling they need to take care of everybody in their life doesn't overwhelm them and squander money that they can hopefully have later in life to really help support family and friends?
A couple of weeks ago, we had one of our alumni who's, you know, he's been on Wall Street. He's now working in a place that he deals with a lot of professional athletes. And he actually told all our guys different stories on how different athletes that have gone into the NFL manage that exact problem and kind of siphoning off certain people and siphoning off percentages as to how they need to think about, okay, X percentage is going to me. This is either going into an ETF or whatever I'm going to be doing to my long-term wealth. And there's this small percentage that I will use to give back. But then also, like, you know, gatekeep who you're giving back to. Like, who are the key people? Like, mom, dad, brothers, sisters. Yes, of course. But like second, third cousins. Like, no, like that's where you've got to stay away. And if you do want to do something for those people, it's not like a monthly stipend or something. What you should do is like just, you know, one event or something where they can feel appreciated, but you are giving back to that core group of family members. So that was really powerful. And then the other piece is just, you know, working with a lot of our guys have agents, working with those agents to make sure that they know where this money's going and how to really gatekeep some of that money.
One of the things that really interests me about the current college football landscape is the transfer portal. Now you go from Duke specifically, right? You lose Riley Leonard to Notre Dame and have him replace a quarterback and the guy who's the face of the program. How do you in your role work with the coaching staff to then go identify the right person to fill that role, especially at a key position? Kind of walk you through how early you identify the talent, what the recruitment process of a transfer like at that level is like, and how you continue to build out, you know, over the ensuing years.
We're always like evaluating talent. We have a scouting team that kind of goes through all the tape of different players. We have the analytical models that will pop up certain players that are performing above expected and are really rated highly. So how it kind of works, that we brought in a quarterback, Darian Mensah, this year, 2 years after Riley. And the way that worked, he popped up on our analytics as somebody that would be a really good fit here. And then I'd take that information, give that to our scouting team to make sure that they watch him, and then give it to our coaches to make sure they watch him as well. And we were all of the opinion, like, yeah, if this kid gets into the portal, then he's got to be our number one target. And I'm sure a lot of other schools, he was their number one target as well. And then when he did get into the portal, it was straight on the phone to his representation, making, you know, flagging our interest and then presenting why this is a good case for him. And that from a coaching standpoint, the degree, like he came from Tulane, so their quality degree as well. So selling him on that, the alumni network, and then the ability to get to the NFL from here as well. So those were the four key pillars that we pitched to his representation. Then they took that to Darren. I think they probably got, you know, 6 or 8 other schools that pitched what their case was, and then narrowed the field down to 3. We were fortunate where we were going to be his first visit. And then we just knew from that point, we didn't want to let him get away. After that, kind of, he agreed to the first visit. I negotiated the deal with his agents to a number that we were both really comfortable with. He came on his visit, and then we were fortunate he wanted to commit. There were some compliance issues, so he had compliance regulations. He can't commit on the day of your visit. You have to wait till 24 hours till you leave. And then once he committed, he obviously canceled his other visit. So we're really lucky with that, how that played out.
A good one in the transfer portal. Another thing that has a lot of people maybe concerned is the timing of the portal windows, right? We saw, I think just last year, the backup quarterback at Penn State, who had a major role in their offense as a gadget player, more or less, transfers to Missouri right before the playoffs because that fitted within the academic window too, right, to get enrolled. How do you guys navigate that? Where do you think the NCAA should go? Because it doesn't seem to make sense that if you're going to allow all this to happen and delay the football season, that we still have to fit within an academic window that doesn't match up with the athletics driving all of the revenue.
Yeah, it's interesting. So the NCAA just came out saying that we're going to go down from 2 portals to 1. It's going to be at the start of January, which obviously doesn't fix the problem that you just mentioned. I think if you ask 68 head coaches, like, what's your favorite time for the portal, they'll give you this powerful, they all give you different answers. So for us, with the academics and things like that, like, it probably made sense if they just kept the spring portal in April and got rid of the January portal, just because our school term starts so much earlier. But yeah, you will get those weird situations where schools will still be in the playoff and, you know, they'll have players transferring and thinking about transferring. And it's definitely not a perfect system. And that's why I think, yeah, the more thought that can go into that and try to develop a general consensus, but it's going to be really hard. Some schools, because the challenge with what I just proposed about the spring portal is, well, coaches will say, well, that way we don't get the players in spring to practice with our team and do all that. So there's drawbacks to every approach unless we move the playoff way earlier, which won't work with the season, and we'll have to move everything else up.
And Vinod, just to take a step back for a moment, this is all amazing information. It sounds like you've got a lot of people who rely on you. You have a lot of players that look to you, you know, for advice and such. So I'd like to know a little bit about who mentored you growing up, or, you know, was there someone that might have, you know, given you a chance, or just tell us one of those stories if you have one.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think obviously my parents and, yeah, they were important growing up. But then from a career perspective, I think the GM of the Adelaide Crows, Justin Reid, like when he hired me back in 2017, end of 2017, whatever that was, like it was a big risk for him because like Australian football hadn't really embraced analytics and things like that. And he was, you know, considered one of the best GMs in Australian football. And he made the decision to actually get rid of a certain scouting position so they could bring me in. And then he gave me exposure from day one to how he negotiates with agents, how he constructs his salary cap, how he wants to think through trade deals and play contracting deals. And just, it was like such a steep learning curve. It felt like drinking from fire hose. But the fact that he gave me all that exposure so early on has just helped me so much. Like, I'm in debt to him forever. And like, we still speak, the Australian football trade period's about to kick off. But yeah, we still speak about different deals that he's thinking about. And then he gives me advice on certain challenges I'm having here at Duke. And it's a really great relationship. But yeah, he's probably the number one kind of mentor that I've had.
Yeah, but Nick, if you could walk us through, you know, you started with Coach Elko, right? He leaves to go to Texas A&M, and you mentioned you just weren't in a position to go, you know, family dynamics and whatnot. What's it like being a, you know, not a holdover, but someone who's been with the prior coaching staff, knowing how they like to do things in this ever-changing world of collegiate athletics, going to a new staff and really trying to make your imprint and finding your way there to build a roster the way the new coaching staff wants it?
Yeah, I think what's actually helped being a holdover is like having established relationships already with the athletic department, with all our key donors as well. That made it easy for me to get our coaching staff in front of those people. And that allowed me to get a lot of buy-in because fortunately I've got some relationships with the key donors, and they, you know, helped me navigate some of the challenges that we had just, you know, trying to raise money and do all these things. We've obviously got a really good fundraising team as well. And being able to have success in that really helped me to establish buy-in with our coaching staff because, yeah, they could see that I was somewhat competent. And then through that, by continually bringing players up based on the analytics and, you know, getting ahead of certain negotiations and things like that, that have helped us retain players. Like, I think we're the second fewest portal entries in the whole Power Four last year. That retention's a big piece of what we do. And obviously that credit goes to Coach Diaz and his staff. We were able to put contracts in front or numbers in front of people that they were comfortable with to stay. So those type of things helped me establish buy-in because no coach wants to see any of their best players leave.
One thing I'm curious about too is as college football becomes more and more like professional, how do you work with NFL teams to gather maybe a feel for information they're looking for so that you can help model the best numbers you can and help your players understand where they need to improve to help their draft status, how you can help better develop them to fit what the NFL is looking for? What's that working relationship like with NFL front offices and folks like yourself?
Yeah. So I will push back a little bit on the professional aspect just because that, like, when people say that, it's hard for me to quantify what that means because there are some teams that are run so well that are in the NFL, in the NBA. And then there are some teams that, yeah, trade away unprotected draft picks for a 3-pick slide in the first round, which is crazy. So like, there's such a vast spectrum of like what professional teams mean. It's like all about details and processes and establishing those processes. So we have a really close relationship with the Philadelphia Eagles. Myself, we have a GM of player personnel, and our chief of staff spent a couple of days out there in the summer. And then I actually had the VP, I don't know his exact title, but VP of player personnel in my office last week, just going through a lot of these cap machinations, how they do things, how we do things, explaining why it's not so much a like for like. But those conversations are ongoing. Also got some great relationships with some professional basketball teams, obviously through our network here, that I can lean on them for advice as well. But those guys are somewhat fascinated by the challenges we have because we just don't really have as many rules as they do. So they'd love to get their hands on some of this stuff and provide some really cool ideas. But yeah, we do leverage those teams all the time.
Looking ahead, where do you see NIL heading in the next 3 to 5 years? And how is Duke positioning itself to stay ahead of the curve?
That's a million-dollar question. I think everyone's trying to work that out. It's hard. So what Duke's doing is investing in football, because I think, and that goes, like, it's a testament to our athletic director, Nina King. She understand the value of football, and it would have been very easy to, you know, lead on at the basketball with a basketball school with high academic credentials. But football drives a lot of the revenue, and that's publicly available even at a place like this. So investing in football for us to build something sustainable, I think that will allow us to be invited to whatever the next iteration of college football is. I don't think that we're done yet with all the changes, so I don't know exactly what those changes are, but there's a lot of talk, probably in your world's more than mine, about, you know, private equity coming in. Is that feasible? Maybe, maybe not. Is it a breakaway Super League type situation? There are all these things that are being proposed. I'm actually reading a book. It's called, I don't know if you guys can see it, Forward Progress, the Definitive Guide of the Future of College Football. There's nothing definitive in here. So I don't think anyone knows. Everyone's just hypothesizing and got these ideas. So yeah, but whatever it is, we are trying to position ourselves to be invited to that by building a really good team and investing in this space.
Now, this is something that maybe not directly in your world. College football is driven by television contracts and conference alignment. We've seen a lot of changes within that, to the point where, you know, we have teams in California playing in Atlantic Coast leagues. It, like, as a football fan, the geography doesn't make any sense anymore. So how do you guys navigate at Duke being a part of a conference, what that means for TV deals, balancing that with basketball obviously being a major driver of revenue, and then how that all funnels down to you and building a football team?
It's funny that you know, I asked that question this week. We're going out to California this week, and our chief of staff has put together a plan where where we're trying to adjust our guys' schedules to get more on Pacific time earlier in the week and do certain things that will hopefully help us hit the ground running over there. But I think with all this conference realignment talk and all this cross-country travel, like, the key thing is, like, first of all, like, understanding our recruiting footprint is now the whole country, and it has been for a while. And, you know, there are people in California that'll come out to see us play, and there are kids that hopefully get attracted to the way we play, and that might lead to a recruiting thing, and they might not have been able to watch us elsewhere. But I think the key is, like, as long as you're competitive, all these realignment things will work in your favor. Like, I think that's the key thing, because people want to bring good teams into whatever the next iteration of this is, like I mentioned before. So that's all that we're focusing on, is being competitive and trying to win as many games as possible to build something that is sustainable so we don't get left behind.
You're in a content world. You have quality content, meaning productive teams that win. TVs are going to, you're going to get more eyeballs on television, and you're going to be part of those deals.
Yeah. And it's something you could talk with the Eagles, I'm sure, about, with your relationship and how to deal with cross-country travel, which is a new thing for most football teams. It's just a fascinating changing landscape. It's a lot to keep up with as a, you know, just a casual fan. So it's great to get this insight from you. It's very unique.
One more question, Benelk. Something we like to ask every guest on our podcast is, what does sweat equity mean to you?
In my role compared to the players' roles, it's very different. But I think, yeah, so I'll talk about it from my perspective. I think the sweat equity is like taking the time to plan and put processes in place that will serve you in, as we've touched on, like the fast-moving transfer portal world, the fast-moving NIL negotiation world. But also, like, a little bit more than that is like taking the time out to build relationships. I think one of the key things for us is to retain our players, but then so it's building relationships with the players, their family, whatever representatives they have. A lot of that stuff goes unnoticed in my role and in people's similar role across the country. But the more that you can build relationships with these guys, is the more that they'll trust you. And then when you do have to get to a, you know, heated negotiation, it's always coming from a place of trust for both parties. So they know that, you know, we won't screw them. And that's a big factor in this, because, you know, as you guys probably would have read, there are so many stories of schools misleading players and things like that. And that's something that, we don't want to do. And that's why I think the relationship building part, not just with that side of things, but athletic department, donors, all of that stuff really matters. So, yeah, that's probably the definition of sweat equity here, is building relationships and not sacrificing.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice,
and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review Client Relationship Summary, provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.